space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
seven, six, five, four, three, two, one, zero. Blast off!
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Everybody, you're listening to the Mad Science Show at www.shazizradio.com. If you want to join in on the chat, jump over there to the superchat.html where you have access to not just one but three separate chat rooms. So with that said, what in tarnation is the Mad Science Show all about? What's its purpose? Sometimes I gotta reiterate the purpose of the Mad Science Show. Mad Science Show is all about making a better quality of life for individuals all over this planet. Alright, most of us are at the mercy of the power companies. You know, we want to be able to reach over there and flip the switch and turn the light on. But if we could find a cheaper and easier method by which to produce the electricity to fulfill our needs, such as our air conditioning and heating and such, and everything we do to, you know, for our enjoyments, computers and all, then, you know, we wouldn't have to pay so much out a month. Now, see, if I was completely off the power grid, I could save myself anywhere from $300 to $500, maybe even $600 a month, depending on what the weather was like outside. If it's really hot outside and the air conditioners have to run constantly, then I'm going to use a lot of electricity. Matter of fact, when my bill comes around, it's always got a little notice down there that I use 70% more than all my surrounding neighbors. So apparently my houses are energy hogs. So 70% more than all my neighbors. So I need to find a solution. I definitely financially wise, I need to find a solution for alternative energy sources. Yeah, I could go solar. I could go wind. I could go thermal. I could probably even go hydro. But I'm trying to find a solution that will not just benefit me, but a solution that will benefit everyone in such a affordable manner that, you know, these things that you need to purchase or have designed aren't going to be, you know, really expensive. There's tons of ways to get off the grid. I posted in the chat room on there. There's a video that basically is about running a gasoline engine off of wood gas. Shows how to make a simple wood gasifier in there. That's just one of many methods of hydrogen technology and different, you know, biofuels and, you know, people running diesel engines off of, you know, basically popcorn, not popcorn, but oh, doggone it, French fry oils and stuff like that. Diesel engines will run pretty good off of a lot of different types of biofuels and oils. So with that said, even the wood gasifier doesn't necessarily have to be wood. It's just, since this is a carbon-based world, then there's a lot of different things that you could actually gasify to actually turn into fuel. Matter of fact, just about everything around is made of fuel. But nonetheless, finding a simple solution to help benefit people around the world. See, there are places that they classify as third world countries that don't have access to the luxuries that we have over here, you know, in the Western world or wherever. It's just, it's a shame because I think that everybody out there should be able to you know, enjoy the modern technology and all the luxuries that we've all been accustomed to. Fresh water included. Sorry, I had to take a drink of my coffee. It was a long night, and so I need my coffee. But anyway, so I've done a lot of research in all different directions and all different types of alternative energies. And I found a lot of different scam artists out there, and I found a lot of good researchers and people that had a lot of really good ideas, and they needed to put those ideas together with other people's ideas and make things function. But, like I said, the whole purpose of the Mad Science Show was to bring these people to the table. To build the dream team, so to speak. People who have researched in all different types of technologies and have understanding of electrical power and such. Electricity is free. Energy is free. We're surrounded by it. Doggone, I gotta get me another drink of coffee. I hate it when that happens. So anyway, trying to figure out ways to harness into everything out there to be able to still run the same inefficient appliances that we already run it. You know, trying to get society to catch up to our potential. It's almost almost impossible. So, the only way any change is ever going to come about is if the average Joe does it. If we stumble across the magical circuit box, and we make them and share the technology with each other. You know, before there was electricity, people did just fine. Man, I'm having trouble here. Sorry about that. Anyway, before electricity, people did just fine. They had candles and they had wood-burning stoves and they was able to cook and all that kind of stuff. But as technology advanced and we actually got the light bulb, it was nice to not have to stub your toe on things in the dark trying to get through there. And it was a lot safer than having an open flame for for lighting and heating and such. So we found all kinds of better ways in order to do stuff. That's all we're trying to do now. Trying to find a way to basically do what we already do, but so much more efficiently and so much more cheaper, basically making things better. You know, the technology's already there, it's just making things better. I posted a video in a chat room a few days back called Solve, where I took a 9-volt battery that only had like 7.3 volts in it. And I ran it through a little homemade mini generator that I made out of a 12-volt motor and a doggone it, I'm having trouble over here. That I made out of a 12-volt motor and a mini microwave oven carousel motor. And I started off with the battery and I run it into a motor controller and basically in through the little electric motor and then into the generator head made out of the carousel motor and then into a bridge rectifier and then basically charged a nickel metal hydride battery up to 8.5 volts. To some, that might not seem too impressive. But for a man who's been doing research in alternative energy for a long time, it's a big deal. Been doing a lot of thinking in the last few days about how things work. I posted a video, the latest video that I posted in there, was a 1.5 volt to 220 volt AC inverter. So you're taking 1.5 volt AAA battery or AA battery, either one. That could even be a C size or a D size. They all 1.5 volts. And running it through a circuit to boost the power up to 220 volts AC. So I got thinking about that. And I also posted in the chat rooms down there. Let's see, where's it at? I reposted. Stop it. Doggone it. Alright. I reposted a flyback driver that was made by Ludic Science that had a MOSFET, a resistor, and a 12-turn center tap wire that was pushing a flyback transformer and producing about 10,000 volts or more. I also posted, let me see, maybe I didn't. Let me see here. Oh, I didn't post that one. Stephen Gibbons posted in the chat room an arc lighter tutorial, a plasma flyback transformer. So basically, all we've been doing all along is mimicking a magnetic field. When you take a rotor out of a generator head, and you look at it really good, you'll notice that there's grooves in there. And those grooves are like timing gears. They make and break a circuit. So modern day generator heads are made to basically go in the range anywhere from 50 to 60 hertz, maybe a little bit higher frequency range of turning this thing on and off, on and off, on and off to produce the AC current, basically fluctuating the magnetic field to produce the power that we use. And because of the way that they're designed, Some are capable of putting out, you know, 1500 watts. Some are capable of putting out up to 12,000 and higher watts. But there's something to consider. Why is it that one generator head is only capable of producing 1200 watts when another one would be capable of producing 6000 watts? So if we studied inside of those generator heads, there's something different going on. Maybe the same exact size horsepower engine running it, but yet one of them puts out more than the other. And essentially, we got to turn a gasoline generator to basically produce enough torque to continue to turn a generator head to produce electricity that would be under a load and fighting against the lens effect as the electrons are flowing back into the same generator, acting as a brake. But if we didn't have to if we didn't have to turn that generator head with a gasoline engine, if we could mimic that magnetic field and produce the AC current necessary to run our appliances, then we would save on fuel. And exactly what I just said is technology that has already been in existence. We got DC to AC inverters, and we got AC to DC converters. One converts the AC current back into DC current with a system such as a bridge rectifier, simple system. And the other one basically takes a pulsed DC where you're taking and flipping the switch really fast and the energy's going back and forth, and it's basically pulse DC, which is the equivalence of AC current. So now that we got that all figured out, we don't have to have, according to the video that I posted about making a how to make a AAA 1.5 volt battery to a 220 volt AC inverter, using a small circuit board and a transformer, basically they produced a miniaturized DC to AC converter. But the key is, it only took 1.5 volts to do that. And even if you look at all the other inverter technology, it basically they got inverters that will run off of 12 volt car batteries. And depending on how much you're planning on pulling off of this thing, you may have to have a larger battery bank. You may have to go from 12 volts to let's say 36 or 48 volts or even higher in order to produce enough DC to continuously pull a really heavy load on there. But looking at this technology, maybe we've been looking at it all wrong. Instead of using a 12 volt battery to basically run a inverter system that's going to boost that up to 120 volts at whatever watts. Maybe we should be thinking about the circuitry that's involved in all this. See, all you'd have to come up with was enough current to run that inverter. Enough DC current to run that inverter. The video that I showed with the video solved that I just talked about earlier with the 9-volt battery that was down to 7.3 volts. And the way that the energy was transferred from that battery through the system and then over to the charge the other battery up. See, voltage is pressure. And if you want to charge something, you have to raise the pressure higher on the side that is actually sending the energy to the side that you're trying to charge. And if you want to do it rapidly, you have to raise it even higher. So I believe that it's possible to literally design a circuit using MOSFETs or transistors that require a very small input that will literally pressurize your batteries rapidly enough that you can use them on demand. So this little AAA battery, 1.5 volt battery to 220 volt AC inverter, it's basically just mimicking a magnetic field. It's turning that battery on and off, which is energizing the primary coil on the transformer. That flux travels through the laminates of the iron core there, and then basically passes back and forth through the secondary coil winding, which then in turn produces the AC current out the other side. So it's a really simple concept. The concept of basically flipping the switch on and off, on and off, on and off, will give you the AC current. And so in order to be able to do this rapidly, they use transistors or MOSFETs in order to do this. So, it's highly plausible that using this one little circuit like this right here, that you could run that AC current that's already up to 220 volts AC, because you just inverted it from a DC battery and through the circuitry and through the transformer, and then put a bridge rectifier on the opposite side to get enough power to run the next circuit in line. So if inverter technology is capable of changing it from AC to DC, and converter technology can change it from AC back to DC again, the right combination of these, you could literally start to step up the power. The 1.5 volt battery to maybe 3-volt battery, doggone, doubling it every time. 1.5 volt AAA to 2 AAAs, 3 volts, and then on up until you basically take this power and you keep ramping it up. And in the process, you don't drop it down to where you don't have the current any longer. You're just gradually stepping this current up. I hope I'm making sense here. I'm going to see if Muddy wants to join in. Do-do-do-do-do. This is terrible for live radio. I'm typing. Uh-oh. Misspelled. All right, never mind. Huh. Okay, so I'm sitting here trying to type and ask Muddy if he wants to join in. Ed Blassett. Alright. Okay, so anyway, he looks like he's busy. Do-do-do-do. Yeah, I'm live. Alright, so basically, I'm going to be working on some circuitry. You got step-up transformers and step-down transformers. And so I'm going to work on a multi-stage transformer. And I'm also going to work on making a miniature replica of the transformers that you see out there on your power pole. The flyback driver that Ludic Science posted, which I posted a picture, I'll go ahead and repost it into the chat room. If you look at this, it's really super simple. Really super simple diagram. And most of these parts that you need, you can salvage out of old electronics. Not everybody's able to mess around with electronics. But if you took your time and you had the right parts, and he's got it listed on here, the parts and the part numbers. And it's really a super simple idea. You got your power source that basically runs over to your coil, and it has a center point tap which goes over to the positive side of it, and then you got your MOSFET and your resistor, and basically you can follow the coil and see where they all connect up. So you just follow this diagram right here, and you essentially got a high voltage pulsar circuit. Well, the key about this thing is, and the reason why I keep talking about it, is that when you pulse a transformer, you got to have a strong magnetic field to energize that secondary. And if you look at this diagram right here, and you watch the video that I also posted in there of his, he's getting 10,000 volts. So that tells me that he is pulsing that primary strong enough that it's able to energize the secondary of that flyback transformer. Now, of course, flyback transformers work just a little bit different than regular standard transformers, where they actually use some of the flyback off of the back EMF off of the field in order to make it ramp itself up. But the newer magnetic ballast that they use in lighting do the same exact thing, and they don't have a secondary. They only have a primary. So basically, you can still utilize the same exact effect. When the switch closes, it energizes the coil, and when the switch opens, it basically produces a rush of power, like turning that light on really fast. So this simple. I'm getting distracted by somebody in the Skype chat. Sorry about that. So, essentially, this little circuit right here, I believe with a few modifications, and maybe not even necessary to modify, that you would be able to pulse any coil out there and utilize that back EMF as AC voltage with plenty enough current to run what you need. See, in permanent magnet generators, it's relying on the I'm changing that doggone thing. Alright, there, I'm not looking anymore. Alright, anyway, what I was trying to say is, in a permanent magnet generator, you got a gasoline engine or diesel engine that has to have some torque and has to have some RPMs in order to produce the voltage that you're going to use off of that generator. And all it's doing is spinning those magnets past the windings in the generator. That's it. So in order for us to do that, all we have to be able to do is replicate that magnetic field expanding and collapsing. We can do this with transistors and MOSFETs. And so with that said, we could build really powerful circuits using transistors and MOSFETs that don't require a lot of voltage input. And so if we can get one that will literally run off of a 12 volt battery, which pretty much we do because that's what inverters do, but then inverters will, depending on how much load you put on them, begin to drain the battery down. We don't want to do that. We need another system that is going to put energy back into that battery fast enough that it's not going to drain that battery down. And utilizing outside sources like solar, you're able to basically charge up large battery banks and then be able to run big inverters that actually run your house anywhere from 12,000 watts and more. Some systems are a lot less depending on your needs. But I honestly believe that using the inverter and converter technology, that we can get the same amount of power out for less amount of input. Because all we need to do is to be able to mimic that magnetic field. That's it. And as far as the lens effect, using high voltage windings on the secondary could be one of the ways in which that we reduce the lens effect and change that energy to a completely different state before we actually use it. Basically put a gap in between the two different ones, the one that you're producing energy with and the one that you're taking energy off of, putting a gap in between there that will not allow electron flow back in the opposite direction, producing that second magnetic field, which is the lens effect. So if you're listening in and you take this circuit and basically build you a transformer, or utilize this circuit to pulse other existing transformers to see what kind of current you can get out the other side, what kind of wattage, and then expand on this. Instead of this simple circuit where you only have one MOSFET pulsing this coil, maybe you could go to two systems side by side pulsing, and then possibly the three and four and on up to two, see how far that you could actually take this design. you could have a multi-stage where one is being done by solar, one of these MOSFETs is being pulsed by solar, one of them's being pulsed by wind power, one of them's being pulsed by thermal energy, and so on down the line, and actually be able to pull some of the energy back off of these MOSFETs or transistors if they begin to get hot from the deal. You can basically reuse that, what would have been normally wasted energy. I gotta take a music break so I can catch my breath. So I don't know what's going on with me today. Stay tuned, you're listening to Mad Science.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Yeah, could you describe the ruckus, sir? All right, I'm back. Hopefully that works out better. Thanks for the idea there, Stephen. So, basically what we're talking about here is efficiency and frequency. The magnetic field, if you can pulse it at the right frequency and it produces the same strength of magnetic field that the generator head itself is working at, then you should be able to get the same amount of power out the other side. And so, this little circuit right here that Ludic Science put together, I believe it could be as simple as that circuit right there. Maybe add a potentiometer so that you can turn the power input up and down, either up to maximum or down halfway or to its bare minimum or whatever, to where you gives you some sort of range in between of how fast that switch is coming on and off. And so with that said, I believe that getting out from underneath the thumb of the power companies is going to be something as simple as that. Not necessarily, it's definitely not over unit. We're not trying to get out more than we're trying to put in. We're just trying to do the same amount of work for less amount of input, which right now we basically waste the majority of all the energy that we use, we waste. And so this would bring you down to where this thing is as efficient as it can possibly be. And all it's doing is basically mimicking the magnetic field that your average generator produces as the rotor is spinning and making and breaking the power with the lines of flux that's actually going through the coils, energizing the electrons and so on. So I'm going to be doing a lot of experiments in ranges with these transistors and MOSFETs, and I'm going to be pulsing a lot of different coils, everything from low voltage all the way up to high voltage, and be able to find that sweet spot that we'll run that either a inverter or a converter, or both, or a combination of all of the above. See, right now you could take a 12 volt battery, and well, according to that video there, you can do it with less, 1.5 volt. But you can take a 12 volt battery and you can run a little circuit where it allow you to run a 110 AC appliance from the cigarette lighter in your car. So all I have to be able to do is produce enough energy to energize that circuit and allow it to run. That's it. And so I know that I have to be able to match the equivalence of that battery. And if I can match the equivalence of that battery by gradually stepping that power up, then I could put that circuit together and be able to run this inverter with a lot less input on the power input side. And even that, the same circuit could be used to basically do what Ludic Science did and pulse a flyback transformer and move that frequency to a higher voltage, higher pressure, that will charge capacitors rapidly. So essentially, somebody out there on YouTube made a transformer out of PVC and microwave oven transformers and had it inside there with oil. But I want to build a version of it that not only converts it, steps it up or steps it down, but will also store it like a capacitor as well. So it would actually have built-in capacitors inside this transformer that is submerged in mineral oil, something that's non-conductive. And from that, you can take the high voltage input just like you would from the power company off the power lines going down into the transformer that's on your pole that actually runs, steps that voltage down and runs it into your house. See, the voltage coming across those power lines are at a higher frequency, and it has to step that down in order to be able to use it in your house. Otherwise, that net high voltage will burn your wiring in your house up, and you won't be able to fry your toasters and everything. So that's what that transformer does, that transformer out there on the pole does. It brings it from a super high voltage to a high, and a high frequency down to a low voltage and gives you that current that you need to run your appliances and stuff. So what I'm talking about doing here is the same exact thing, but on a smaller scale that, moves that voltage just like the way that the power companies are moving it, but gives you the storage potential and the current flow that's necessary to run the inefficient appliances that we use for less amount of input. So basically just taking the efficiency level to its maximum potential. That's it. And being able to mimic the magnetic field to wherever it's necessary for the sweet spot that will give you the current flow out the other side. It's a simple concept. All right, well, Justin wandered in, so let me see if I can get him. This is terrible for live radio. So, you're live on the air. Did you want to join in there, Justin?
Yeah, for sure. What's up? So, just good morning.
Good morning. Basically, talking about a different way of using electricity, a more efficient way of using electricity with least amount of input possible. Basically, taking all the knowledge that we've got and making things better.
Okay.
So we got inverter technology and converter technology to work with. Posted some videos in the chat room of one of them has a 1.5 volt to 220 volt inverter. It's a simple inverter. That's to turn DC into AC, and then there's also AC to DC converters, which is could be as simple as a bridge rectifier to bring it back into DC. But I think the key to all of this is going to be in a little simple circuit that Ludic Science did. Is basically a MOSFET resistor and a winding around a flyback transformer gives you 10,000 volts. And so essentially mimicking the magnetic field, that's it. That's all we're doing. The rotor inside of the magnetic rotor inside of a permanent magnet generator. Basically, the rotor has lines cut in it, and there's brushes on there that will make and break the circuit and turn it off and on really fast and producing the AC current that we get out of the generators. And then if we need to rectify it back, we can go the opposite direction with the same technology. But what I'm proposing here is a better method of doing what we've been doing by gradually stepping the voltage up, starting from 1.5, maybe 3, and then on up to whatever, all the way to 12 volts by building a custom circuit that will mimic that same magnetic field with less effort, if you understand what I'm saying. Not trying to get out more than you're putting in, but to bringing it to its maximum potential of efficiency. Does that make any sense to you?
Oh, I comprehend what you're saying, yes.
So, essentially, I believe it's possible to build, using inverter and converter technology, the perfect circuit that won't even get hot. You can, if you need to ramp the voltage up to try to bypass the majority of the lens effect, and then change that energy to something completely different, and then move it over into a storage tank that in turn can bring it back around to where it's actual usable current again, using inverter and converter technology in different stages, you could build the perfect generator, is what I'm saying. So if I could get the right people together, I mean, I can do this myself. I know I can do it myself, but if I could get the right people together, we could actually build in kit form some deals that would basically pulse any coil that you could find, any transformer that you could find, and mimic what that transformer does without having to have, you know, like an internal combustion engine next to it or whatever. You see what I'm saying? Hello?
Well, not really.
All we gotta be able to do in order to generate the AC current that we need in our houses is to mimic what's going on inside of that generator using solid state equipment. Instead of moving parts, you don't have moving parts, you just have transistors and MOSFETs that are making and breaking that circuit and causing it to either ramp the voltage up for a brief second and then drop it back down to raise your current up and so on. You see what I'm saying?
How the modern microwave works now, they don't use a transformer inside of the microwave, they use MOSFETs now.
Yeah, inverter technology.
Right.
And they're able to...
I prefer going from AC to DC using bottles, and DC to AC using bottles instead.
Well, you're talking about basically capacitors.
No, what you do is you take a bottle, you put your cathode, your anode in it, and you put a vacuum on it, and you wrap a coil around it. Your coil is your AC wire. You have your AC current going into the wire, but that induces the inside of the bottle, but the bottle, it could only be directed because it's got a cathode anode. It's like a spark gap. It becomes directional. Same thing.
Here.
If you pulse inside the bottle and you have a coil on the outside of the bottle, you don't have to do anything simple.
Well, I need to be able to build a PCB board and circuits with off-the-shelf things. And as far as capacitor technology, it's so ridiculously simple to make a capacitor, it's crazy. Let me, I'm going to reset this call and see if I can get Muddy in here. Right.
Okay.
Sorry about that, folks. Nope, can't get him in there. Alright, looks like it's just you and I. You there? Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Alright. So, Stephen Gibbons asked if that's the Leyden jar capacitor you're talking about.
No. It's not a capacitor. It's a bottle with a cathode and anode inside of it. And it's vacuumed out. That's it. When you wrap a coil around the outside of the bottle, it induces the inside of the bottle, causing a potential force inside, and it could only go in one direction, creating DC voltage out of AC.
You talking about like some of the old vacuum tube rectifiers?
I can barely hear you.
I said, are you talking about like the old vacuum tube rectifiers that they had in TVs and stuff?
Yeah, but none of these were in TVs. Ed Lee Scallion had some of them hanging on his wall.
Well, anyway, I think the simplicity. I think when people get this all figured out, which I believe I've already got it figured out, that it's going to be something so ridiculously simple in order to do the same work for less amount of input. And once again, we're not talking about getting out more to put in. We're talking about if you actually observe energy and how it actually functions. If you take a little bit of vapor of fuel and you ignite that fuel, the reaction that you get is multitudes times stronger than it would be if you was using it instead of a vapor in a stream. You understand what I'm saying? So, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
So, I believe that electricity is the same exact concept. Just the same way that water pressurizes, electricity pressurizes, and so on and so forth. And sudden burst of energy, like Tesla showed back in the day, by flipping that switch really fast and getting that sudden rush in of energy and ramping that voltage sky high, and even being able to, by how fast you turn this thing on and off, raise the frequency incredibly. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Man, it's like these dead spots on radio are terrible. Alright, I think...
What dead spots?
Like, I don't know, I'll say something and then there's a pause for about 30 seconds. And What the heck is wrong with Muddy?
I like to think before I speak, right?
Yeah. Alright, well...
What is it? What is it?
Anyway, I don't know what Muddy's problem is here. He can't get in there somehow. Maybe I could end this call and he can call us back. This is probably going to be the second worst show ever.
Why? Here, Ohm's Law. Everybody talks about lens. Lens can only occur in like an inductor. It's a time domain, right? So the only thing that they don't put in Ohm's Law is cycles per second. you increase the cycles, you increase the voltage. The amperage drops, and the wattage increases after three phase.
Well, that's what my whole purpose of doing what I'm talking about here is that we don't need all the wattage. We don't need all the amperage until a certain point. All we need to do...
Wattage is the reverberation in the line. It's the emissions.
There's a lot of wasted energy in those power lines. If you can take a wireless AC tester 30, 40 feet away from that power line and pick up a field, that's a lot of wasted energy. And you don't need that giant field around that in order to be able to get the same amount of work done. All you have to do is have these magnetic fields be able to interact with each other. And so that current that's coming down that power line is way more than you'll ever use. It just has to be that high so that they can send it all the way from the power company to your house. So basically what I'm saying is, using a smaller circuit, you would be able to mimic that same frequency range and pressurize your own transformer without having to have that amount of input that's coming from the power line. You see what I'm saying? All we got to do is be able to mimic
Voltage is the potential difference from the rotor stator.
Voltage is pressure, and that's all you need to charge anything. I proved that in that video that I did.
When you increase frequency in a single line, the line could be 40 gauge, and you can still light up a 1,000-watt light bulb off of that 40 gauge and touch that 40 gauge and not be hurt. And it'd be cool to touch.
Well, I understand.
We don't need big, thick wires. Even the wires that we have now are way too big.
I understand all that. That's basically what I'm saying. You don't need that much power shoved into that transformer in order to get the energy that you need. See, they got to be able to build up enough current that when that meter has basically a little electric motor in there, and it turns the numbers on there to be able to charge you. Well, at the ranges that I'm talking about, that meter wouldn't even move. There's not enough current flow in that system to that point to cause it to move. You see what I mean? There's a guy out there called Gerard Morin. I thought about trying to get him on the radio show, but he does a lot of, colorful language, so I didn't want to, do that. But nonetheless, doesn't take away from his brilliance. He took a 2,500-watt generator and run it into a 50 kV transformer, and then took that 50 kV transformer and dumped it down into a 25 kV transformer, and ran more stuff off of that generator than he should have been able to. He had to run it direct. That generator would have dropped on its face due to the lens effect. The back EMF would have basically slowed down the armature until that generator overheated and shut down. But he used the same technology that I'm talking about, the same concept of taking a frequency range that which it won't even burn up your stuff. And he actually measured the top of that transformer to measure for the amperage and current flow and all that. And that's something that you wouldn't do in real life on a regular transformer under the normal conditions. Otherwise, you're liable to get lit up, because that's why they have to have them wires so far apart on the deal, so that that current can't jump from one side to the next. But he didn't have any problems. And essentially, what he ended up with was what some people like to call cold electricity. You understand that concept?
Comprehend, yes.
Comprehend. Are we in a terminology battle again?
Cold electricity is pneumatic. E-pneumatic.
So what's your point?
It's the atmospheric pressure that's oscillating back and forth. The cool breeze. It's vibration. Vibratory physics is what quote-unquote cold electricity really is. It has nothing to do with the P vector of the inductor, only the S vector.
So if you're talking to the average Joe, how are you going to explain that to the average Joe?
Well, our bioferromagnetic brain has receptors. Eyes, ears, nose, mouth, right? Optical. Your ear is a diaphragm. That's pneumatic. That stimulates the neural electrons in your brain, right? If we don't see it, we don't perceive it. When a tree falls in the bush, does it make a sound? Things are a lot deeper than what people could even acknowledge.
Alright, well, the whole idea here is to bring this down to a simpler system, which I feel like the answers are already there. It's already ready.
Right, and it is there. Just go and build something and there we go, we got it. It's not hard. Whatever kind of generator, solar panels, and you can go and spend $5,000 and get a hole drilled into your property into a natural gas line, and there you go, stick your car on it. Generate the whole house, you know what I mean? Like, there's so many different ways to do it, and there's so many easy ways to do it. Come on, back in the 1700s and 1800s, our forefathers, our erstwhile fathers, were living off of the grid. They never needed it.
Of course they didn't.
We only got on the grid for convenience.
Of course they didn't.
For industrial reasons, mainly.
Here we are.
Commercialization.
Here we are in the here and now. People's already become accustomed to energy, and they've found themselves under the thumb of the power companies. Mad science job
really,
is
120 volts. Is really 100 amps at 100 volts really that hard to achieve?
No. The mad science job.
That's why, like, I don't get it. Like, if their goals are to power their house and be off the grid, it's not that hard. There's so many ways.
Well, put your answers on the table. That's the simple thing, man. That's what we're here to do, is to put the answers out there on the table for people. Because this world is ridiculous, man. People are paying anywhere from $300-$400 a month up to run the luxuries that they're accustomed to. I'm sitting here saying that it can be done easier, more efficient, and with less input, without violating any of the known laws of physics that everybody likes to complain about.
Well, people are saying they don't want to work and they want to be home with their kids more. But yet they want the boat and the truck and the car and they want the motorhome and they want the nice 5-bedroom house. You know what I mean? So our time that we, our life is what we emit, right? Like that, if you want to, you can go and do what you want. You can live on the grid or off the grid. You're going to exchange time no matter what, right? Like the farmer up here in Canada, he's got to cut his wood, get his food ready for his dogs. That's fishing and this and that. Or he can come here, push buttons at GM for 40 hours a week, come home, and sit on his butt and feed his dog
store-bought food. What's that got to do with alternative energy sources? It don't.
I'm just saying.
It don't have nothing to do with it. Because here's the deal, man.
Time is time.
It don't.
Whether we put it into creating alternative energy or just going to work and pushing buttons. They're both achieving the same thing.
Look.
Some sort of comfortability.
This. The reason why I call it mad science is because there's an easier way to do it out there than what we're doing right now. And I know that the mainstream scientists know it. I know that the mainstream electrical engineers should know it, but they don't know it because they've been taught that it's not possible. I'm here to say that it is possible. I'm here to prove that it is possible. In my last video...
It's been proven a million times. People are living off the grid every day. More and more people are moving off the grid.
Sure. And more people are getting busted by the government for trying. But look...
That's a mental psychosis. That's a cognitive illness. That's like something that's not even worryable. That's living in fear, right?
Oh, look, man. Alright, if I got... Let me tell you a story. There was a true story. There was a real individual who basically figured out a way by which he could plug into one outlet in his house and run a generating system that would run the rest of his house. All right, so the technology's been there all along. This one individual was able to run his entire house off the equivalence of one single outlet. And so the power company knew that he had to be using more power than he was paying for, and they actually tried to get him for stealing electricity. But in reality, he wasn't stealing nothing. He was paying for everything he used. But when it was all said and done, he didn't get in no trouble. But somebody paid him off to not tell anybody how to do what it was that he was doing. You see what I'm saying? So, it's not...
If I go buy some batteries and put some solar panels up and a couple little windmills, the government's not going to bother me. I'm off the grid. Nobody's bugging me.
I'm not worried about the government. I'm just trying to get people to understand that there's a better way than what they're doing and to show them the easiest way to do it. Let's see. Somebody in the chat room said, this is kind of off topic from what you guys have been talking about, but Shaziz, or anybody really who has a good understanding, but basically I understand electrons because I have taken school and have done my own research and have kind of started to look more into Eric Dollard, but basically... How should I view electrons? What exactly are causing them? And how do I enlarge my mind's view and understanding of electrical energy? Where is my best source? And what are your thoughts on how energy truly works? Well, this is how I believe it works.
Atmospheric pressure. Completely 100%. When we look at electricity, it is atomic physics.
Well, I appreciate 100%. That. I appreciate that. Let me finish my sentence thing. That was cool.
Oh, sorry.
All right. I'll let you tell how you think it works. I want to say, look, this is what I believe going on. Nobody has ever seen the electron, period. It's a theoretical existence of something that they say is there, but the electron's supposedly moving so rapidly that you can't even see it. It's so tiny that you can't even see it. What I believe that we're actually working with is what we call a magnetic field, but fluctuations of that magnetic field. It'd be the equivalence of putting your finger in the swimming pool and start tapping on the water, and you see those waves that ripple out. Well, all you had to do was keep that steady motion going, and eventually you get those waves to building up power, building up pressure, until it finally spills over the side of the pool. So, as far as the electron theory, it's easy to explain of how using what the school book taught of how electrons flow, which essentially, I don't believe they're actually trading places. I believe they're actually rocking back and forth, and each field is adding to the next field, just like that same wavelength that we just discussed in the pool. And so that's how we end up getting our current flow. The stronger the magnetic field, the more frequently it goes through the lines of flux from that magnetic field, cross through those copper wires and shake them electrons around, causes them to all interact with each other, thus forth increasing the strength of that field and the pressure of the voltage that's built up inside there. What we know is voltage anyway. We don't even really know what voltage is, truly. All we know is that science says that voltage is pressure. And so with that said, if you've got high enough pressure, you can use that high enough pressure to pressurize a container that is full at a lesser pressure. I hope that makes sense to you. It's the same equivalence of when you're airing up your car tire, and you want to air your car tire up to 32 pounds, you got to have more than 32 pounds of pressure in that air tank that you're taking the pressure off to put into that tire. Otherwise, it can't equal out, if you understand what I'm saying. So you get a little bit more pressure, like 50, 60 pounds in there, and you can easily pressurize that tire up to 32 to 35 pounds or whatever. So, in my view, the electron theory, it makes it easy to explain how we believe electricity is actually traveling. But what it all boils down to is pressure and current. The same exact thing that you would understand if you were into plumbing and you were piping water. You had a large pipe for volume, and you had a reducer that went down to a smaller pipe so that you could take that volume and ramp up the pressure. And so to me, all of it is basically current flow and pressure, volume, current flow and pressure. And that's what we're doing when we're interacting with those magnetic fields. And we're using a brute force mechanical deal to turn magnets past coils of wire to get the same reaction. And I don't believe that we have to go that far in order to be able to do that. I believe that we can simulate it because we have inverter technology. And like you said earlier, Justin, the modern-day microwaves don't have transformers any longer. They have flyback transformers, and they use inverter technology drivers for that. That circuit that I posted in the chat room is basically the equivalent of that circuit in a smaller, simpler, easier-to-understand scale. Now, what was you saying, Justin?
Well, when we look at electricity, it doesn't matter what apparatus or part of it that we're using. When we look at the word itself, the semantics, origins, electricity, electron, electron, from Greek, comes from William D. Gilbert, and it means like amber, It's friction. You got your pressure in there that you're talking about. You're right about when you're talking about the salts and the water.
Well, the friction will come from the electrons.
That's called, for terminology, that's called magnetostriction.
The friction.
When they're rocking back and forth, that oscillation. One part of it is salt and one part of it is water. They're bonded together. It's a covalent bond and they rock back and forth.
Yeah, and that friction is what causes the wiring to get hot.
You take your hairbrush, you create static on a brush, and you put it near running water, you see that it pushes away. Everything about our electricity that we use, when we talk about measurement of voltage, we use digital scales. Go back to using a galvanometer, and you'll see deflection. That's what we're talking about, pressure. That's the deflection. You measure that in trigonometry. That's how those numbers, voltage, is what it is.
Well,
but electricity is like what you're saying. It's pressure, movement, all of those things. How it works is on atomic physics and nuclear physics. They're the same, but they're different.
That's why I'm saying that we're not only putting too much power to it, we're putting it in at the wrong frequency, which causes it to build up friction, which is causing it to get hot. And so at the right frequency range, your transformers wouldn't even get hot, but you would still get the same amount of magnetic flux in order to energize your secondary or turn your rotors. That's what
right.
I've been saying.
You know how tuning forks work, right?
Yep.
If you have a tuning fork at 432 hertz and another identical one at 432 hertz, and you ring one, the other one will ring.
Yep.
They're harmonic. It's called harmonic beats, right? It's
also called a sympathetic resonance.
Well, just like a rotor, just the exact same thing with a rotor stator. You have coils, and you have magnets. And when that spins, it has a harmonic beat. You can match the ratio of the revolutions per minute to the coils. So 60 hertz, 50 hertz, those transmissions are not correct results. They're not harmonically coupled in any of the apparatuses that we use.
But nonetheless, it's the current and the way that it's actually being used is destructive. It's wasteful and destructive. And so,
like you say, the heat that were created with Lenz's law and Ohm's and all of that is due to the cycles per second. If you look at the standard triangle, volts, amps, and resistance, or power, however you want to put it, you raise the frequency up in the system, it will transmit even further, and you'll have less wires. These are everything about electricity, from your optical, your sight, to your smell, is just decimal values. The oscillation of everything rocking back and forth, happening, a battery doesn't work until you put the system on it. If I take a vacuum chamber with a resistor inside of it, like a light bulb, and I vacuum it out, and it's connected to the light, to the battery, that atmosphere inside of that vacuum chamber with that resistor is going to give that battery a different equation. Barometric pressure on your electrical systems, that's why each battery has a standard 2 volts per plate, no matter how big the plate is, due to the atmospheric pressure.
Well, normally a headlamp out of a doggone automobile, it's a resistive load. Normally, it's basically requires a lot of current flow in order to cause that resistance, to cause the friction that heats up the tungsten element inside there and lights up the light bulb. However, I've already proven that even a burnt out light bulb at the right frequency can be lit up without all that current flow. You can vibrate that tungsten element so rapidly that it produces heat, which in turn produces light, and be able to light up even a light bulb that no longer would function on the standard system. So what I've been saying all along is it doesn't take near the power that we're using to get the work done that we need done. And these circuits that I keep talking about are going to prove it, because all you have to do is be able to match that magnetic field. And it doesn't even have to be as strong of magnetic field in order to get the work done. All that has to be able to do is interact with the magnetic field. The cores of the transformer, all that does is basically surround those coils with the magnetic flux. It's guidance system. It guides the magnetic field and strengthens it into the center, as opposed to I can't even remember what I was getting ready to say. But nonetheless, all we're doing with the energy that we're producing is sending it down a guide wire. It's already been proven that you don't even need a wire to send it. You can send it wirelessly. But sending it wirelessly means that it's going to go out in waves. And that's what Tesla figured out years ago, that he could literally send electricity through the air at a different frequency range than what any AC or DC current at that time would have been doing. And if you had the right pickup coil on the other side, you could pick that energy up just like an antenna, and because of the frequency, it has enough pressure that it could pressurize storage banks that you could in turn move that energy back into what you need. So we've got wireless chargers right now, and there's wireless energy all around us from all the different radio transmitters and TV transmitters and such. And that same energy that's being transferred, it can literally run your house. But people don't understand how the concept works. See, and this is why I got in a big old fight about current watts and amps, is because they said, well, no, you gotta have this and that and this whatever, otherwise the math don't add up and you can't do that. Well, that's because they didn't understand. Voltage is pressure. That's what science said. Alright? When you got a high frequency, high voltage, you've got a lot of pressure. And in order to fill up any container, you got to have at least equal to the pressure or higher than the pressure in order to get that thing filled. Otherwise, both of them will balance themselves out to where if you got two containers that are one's completely full and you try to put that same amount of pressure into the opposite container, what you're going to end up is half of the pressure in one container and the other half in the other container. So in order to move that amount of pressure, you have to have your pressure higher in your output container to your input container. Otherwise, you're going to just basically balance themselves out. You see what I'm saying?
How much pressure is in this fishbowl?
In what fishbowl?
Fishbowl we live in.
Incredible.
Tesla was taking electricity and he was sending it up through the air. That's pneumatic. Like a speaker.
Every bit of waves out there. He asked about, what about longitudinal waves? Every waveform out there, whether it be wind, water, radio waves, every form of wave energy out there can be stored. You just need the right antenna, the right receiver to pick that up. Like, for example, the the germanium diodes. For some reason, germanium diodes are really sensitive to radio waves because of the material that it's made out of or whatever. And so I did a video a long time ago about wireless charger or whatever. And I also did it in my Free Thinkers. I put a little deal to pick up radio waves to help charge up capacitors. I got both AC and DC capacitors in the same system. But if you got the right antenna, you can pick up any wave, any frequency. It ain't no different than the way that your receiver on your radio, there's thousands of radio stations out there. And until you turn into the right frequency, you're not going to hear them. They're all still there, but you're not going to hear them. So imagine if you had a receiver that would not just pick up one at a time, but pick up thousands of them at a time. That equals pressure from those waves that are coming in from that antenna, and you're pressurizing the container. Does that make any sense to you, Justin?
Yeah.
So any energy can be stored. You can store heat, energy, it doesn't matter.
Is energy being stored or is it reactive?
Well, when we make a capacitor, like a battery.
The battery doesn't become stimulated until you apply the circuit, right? The bubbles
When we make a battery or a capacitor, we created a void. The outside energy, outside pressure is not inside that void. You got a battery or a capacitor, both of them have a negative plate and they have a positive plate in it. For simplicity, we just have two plates. And at their natural state, those two plates are balanced. They're empty. It's basically what we would call a dead battery. What we do when we charge those is we put, according to electron theory, more electrons on one side than on the other. We charge this up in one direction, and let's say the positive plate, the pressure on the positive plate gets higher. It's got more electrons on it. And then how we use that battery is we go from terminal to terminal and we give the electrons a path to be able to flow through the load, such as a light bulb. And then as those electrons are flowing through the load, they're going to meet resistance, which is going to slow them down, which will cause friction, which in turn will cause heat, which will make the light bulb come on. That will slow the energy going down to the other side, but eventually those electrons will balance themselves out and no longer flow in the system. You have a dead battery. You have just as much energy potential in a dead battery as you do in a fully charged battery. It's just that in a dead battery, they're equal on both plates. Does that make sense to you? So all we need to know is how energy travels. And all we need to know is how we're tapping into that energy. Right now, like I said, we use a brute force magnetic field to shake the electrons. They say there's 29 electrons in a copper atom. And the 29th electron is loosely coupled. And so basically we shake that loose. And it trades places with the next one in line and so on down the line because electrons don't want to be right next to each other. They're antisocial, so to speak. And that electron flow is what we call current. And that interaction of those electrons flowing around, changing and releasing their energy every time they bump into each other or trade places is what they believe produces the magnetic field that we use to get work done. So we took a magnet to create a magnetic field to create electricity. If it's as simple as that, then we can do that using solid state things like transistors and MOSFETs. Basically turning a switch on and off rapidly. And as far as our input voltage, we don't need near the input voltage in order to be able to do what it is that we're wanting to do. And so that means that...
Why can't you just make a sphere?
Huh?
Why can't you just make a sphere?
For what purpose?
Well, sphere is a self-capacitor. It has potential, a lot of potential.
But the problem
with... The barometric pressure around us in the atmosphere has a lot of potential. Sphere is the greatest capacitor of all. Talk about Leyden jars and Leyden jars and the arc and all these other things that are all up there on the chain. They all make sense if you know how things work.
Well, either way, all we're dealing with is pressure. That's it. It's that simple.
It's friction. We got laws, but what about effects? Like the tribioelectric effect, the piezoelectric effect. What are these effects? Static. Those are the inquisitive thoughts.
Well, sure. The friction.
The apparatuses that we use today. The friction. Our modern architect.
The friction and the static that you talked about, like the Van de Graaff or the Wimshurst.
What about just walking across the ground? What about hooking the voltmeter up to your own hands?
The Wimshurst.
And seeing if we have a potential polarity. We have an orientation. We have an atmosphere around us. Just like a wire has the right-hand rule around it.
Sure, but then look. It doesn't matter where the energy comes from. That's the point. It doesn't matter.
I know it doesn't matter where it comes from, but when we look at how things work, we can just look at our own body. Like, we talk about levitation. Raise your 1 foot off the ground and you'll see that your oscillation just increases, right? You want to move a big block, just hook up a sawzall to the block and hit it at the right amount of frequency, right? And it will move easily. Like, electricity is not what it's perceived to be.
Of course it's not, and until we get proper terminology down to what we at when we actually know, which right now nobody knows what electricity is. We just know the effects of how it works and so on. We got a general idea of what's going on, but like I said, nobody's ever taken a picture of the electron. It's all theoretical right now.
When we look at the phonon and the photon and the electron and the ion and all of these things, when we look at the terminology, the etymologies and the origins of these words that we use in English, it is really simple. One part is salt and one part is water. Just like a compass. North and south oscillates back and forth. That bondage between the water, the glue, the gluten in Latin.
Either way,
the salt, carbon, which is what we are, the carbon vessel.
The trillions of gallons of water in the ocean is producing a downward pressure. So
Is it downward?
Huh?
Is it downward? Because the rain falls and the bubbles arise. And together, it creates life. What is up and down?
That sounds like some old hippie guru stuff, but nonetheless,
it gets from thought.
We know that water pressure at different levels. We know that the atmosphere around, which has hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen, has its own pressure. Everything, pressure, resistance, friction, all of it. We understand all that. You know, if you understand plumbing, then you understand electricity, at least to the understanding of the best out there who know about electricity. It's as simple as that. It all works the same. It's so ridiculously simple that I made one of my friends extremely mad because I explained to him in such a simple way of how energy travels and how electricity works that he got angry because it didn't match what his school book said. It was a more mathematical, more complex, and not easy for the average Joe to understand kind of deal. So that's why he got so frustrated when I come along after he'd done went to college for many years to get his documentation, and I come along and in a few seconds just told him how much simpler it was than what he thought it was. Did you take plumbing and you take electronics? They're identical, with the exception of the shape and the material that's actually flowing through them. A big pipe to a reducer to a small pipe will raise the pressure up. You have valves that will only open at a certain amount of pressure. You have valves that can be turned up to half or all the way or closed off. So everything that you see in electronics, if you look at a circuit diagram and you go look at a plumbing diagram, they got a lot in common. They both are schematics that have little symbolism on there for check valves and switches and stuff like that. A valve that just opens and closes is the equivalence of a switch. You shut the valve off, then the flow stops and it builds up pressure behind it. The same thing works as a switch in an electrical circuit. You break the circuit and the electricity stops flowing, and so on. So if you understand plumbing and how water travels through plumbing, then you can understand everything there is to know about electricity and electronics. Nature's a perfect teacher if you pay attention to what nature's been doing all along. And the amount of energy that we need, nature can exceed that amount multitudes times over. If we're going to be making our own man-made machines and generators to be able to produce the electricity instead of doing what you were talking about earlier about building perfect capacitors and the way that the body generates its power or whatever, then we need to take everything we know about electricity, electronics, and how all these things function to be able to design circuitry that will do the same job as a mechanical that would put out just as much current as the standard system that we're accustomed to using right now. And in my mind, it's so ridiculously simple, it's not even funny. But putting this into everyone's hands is what I'm trying to do here. I'm trying to get people to go out there and test. Try with off-the-shelf things that already exist, transformers or whatever, and use that simple little circuit that Ludic Science put out there for everybody. It's a really ridiculously simple circuit. It's just about the same circuit as the Slayer Exciter circuit. The Slayer Exciter circuit uses a tip 42C transistor and the equivalents of, and this one here uses power MOSFETs. And all it is, either one of those, are fast acting switches. When the current gets high enough on one side of the MOSFET, it will allow the material on the opposite side to become conductive and allow current to flow through there. When it cools back down, it will shut itself off, and it will do this so rapidly that it'll turn that switch on and off, on and off, on and off really fast, and raise that frequency up And so with a flyback transformer, you're actually getting a field that expands, and as it collapses, it's grabbing off some of that energy. And when the first wave goes out, before it gets a chance to come back, the second wave's coming in. And so you keep bumping that wave. It's the same thing that I mentioned earlier about tapping on that water, that you can produce a wave that will go out and bump the next wave and keep on doing that over and over and over again. All we're doing is moving the medium around that you keep talking about, the water, the molecules, the hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, and all the other gases in the air, and we're sending radio waves through that. You see what I mean? That's the atmosphere with radio waves becomes the copper wire in our transformers and the copper wire in our electric motors. All we're doing is guiding that energy using waves to send that, to get those magnetic fields to interact with each other. It's, like I said, it's so ridiculously simple. Stephen Gibbons posted a video in the chat room, Plumbing and Electricity. It'll give you a general idea, I'm sure. I'm going to have to watch that one later because that's what it is. We use resistance to build up heat. A tungsten element is a resistive material that will withstand a lot of heat, so we use those in heater elements. Nichrome wire is another one. Has a lot of resistance, and so when you put a current to it, it'll get red hot. And so we use that in toasters. So we got two different materials that we know of that are really resistive to current flow that will produce heat. Where'd you go? I think I lost Justin. So, anyway, the same thing where we're normally using for resistive load, we don't need to do that. That's the key. We can use a wavelength where there's a terminology that is called resonance, where any two objects, if you can meet the magnetic resonance or the resonance of the material, you'll cause it to vibrate. And so sending out the right frequency to a specific deal, you can cause it to vibrate. So if you got nichrome wire and you know the resonant frequency of nichrome wire, you can send that exact frequency out and you can cause that wire to vibrate so rapidly that in turn produces friction in the atoms and electrons and produces heat. And so with the less amount of current, less amount of voltage input, you can actually do the same job and make that thing so much more efficient. Cool. Steven said that's a taster from the resource page. Yeah, I need to get back over there and look at that this afternoon. By the way, for those who don't know what I'm talking about, Stephen Gibbs is in the process of making a resource page here at ShazizRadio.com so that you have links to all kinds of different things about alternative energy and such, and he's doing a really good job on it. I can't wait to see when we get ready to go. Thank you very much, Stephen. I'm going to see if I can get Muddy on here. I don't know if you can pick up his phone or not. Do. Once again, terrible for to radio. Are you there?
The person whom you're trying to reach is currently unavailable.
Nope.
Please leave a message.
Nope, not leaving a message. Ain't gonna do it. Alright, anyway, so basically all we're talking about is making things so much more efficient. You know, this little circuit right here, we already know how to produce electricity. Science says that energy can neither be created nor can it be destroyed. Alright, they're always talking about that in the law of thermodynamics. And they're always quoting the same laws and saying why it is you can't do certain things. Alright, for example, hydrogen technology running vehicles. There are so many people out there who are really well educated in the way that the standard internal combustion engine runs that they are totally blinded to any potential of having an engine that would run specifically designed and engineered to run off of water. While on one hand science will tell you that water is the most stable molecule, it also says that water is hydrogen and oxygen. Both is needed for combustion. And so if you have a method by which you can break apart that water molecule, and there are many methods. One of them, the worst method is electrolysis, because it takes a lot of current to bust through there to do that. But there are proven radio frequencies out there that will separate it on demand. There is a video out here on YouTube where a man said that he would sell that information to any oil company so that they could, you know, basically shelve it. He'd sell it to the first company that offered him a lot of money because he was saying he wanted to do research in a different field. And he needed the money to do it. But nonetheless, it can be done. You can send a high frequency radio wave, the equivalence of, to match the resonance of the water molecule and shake it apart. Anything could be shook apart with vibrational frequencies. That's how the opera singer raises the voice up, matches the resonance of the glass, and does it at one pitch higher, and that's all it took was to cause that crystal glass to shatter. So, it was all about basically taking an acoustic wave from her voice, or his voice, whichever, and sending that acoustic wave out, and that wavelength matched the resonance of that glass and caused it to begin to vibrate rapidly and split it apart. The same thing can be done with the water molecule. Diesel engines to this very day use compression ignition. And compression, when you compress a gas, it produces heat. And so, whenever you first start your diesel engine up, all it does is turns on a glow plug long enough to raise the temperature of the cylinders up to the operating range. The compression does the rest. Once it gets up to operating temperature, you no longer need the glow plugs. The glow plugs were just basically to get it up to temperature. The rest of it is from the compression of those gases inside that cylinder. And it causes it to burn. It causes the fuel, which is vaporized and put inside there, to burn. So the same thing, the compression ignition, induction technology, induction heating technology, vaporization, and atomizer technology, you could literally build, specifically design, an internal combustion engine to run on pure distilled water. No ifs, ands, or buts. There's nobody out there brilliant enough in science and physics that can convince me otherwise. See, they don't understand. They always try to use the laws of thermodynamics to say why it is you can't do something instead of looking into how it is you could do something, which is ridiculous. Even Henry Ford said that if you think you can or you think you can't, you're right. But if science is correct, and water is hydrogen and oxygen, and both of them will ignite, then there is no reason why we couldn't specifically design an engine that would run on pure distilled water. And since the Earth is majorly covered in water, you ain't never going to run out of fuel. Period. And so it's time for the engineers out there who want to give a listen to somebody who's paid attention in school, and we can sit there and build. And the same thing with all these circuits. I'm sitting here talking about all these circuits and all these different concepts, and, you know, I'm not asking for nothing in return but a little bit of help. get together and let's build some things and call it a day. You know, we got it fixed. It's not rocket science. If you took and you preheated the water, you could actually bring it up to a water at sea level boils at 212 degrees, I believe they said it was. Maybe it was 112. I can't even remember anymore. Doesn't matter. But nonetheless, with induction technology, yeah, there you go. Stephen Gibbs just posted that link that I was talking about burning water in there. John S. Kansas. He's doing it with radio frequencies, burning water. But using induction heating and steam technology, we can boil the water, we can get it preheated before it ever even goes into an atomizer and then into a vaporizer, and just send just what is necessary for the actual ignition inside the combustion chamber to occur to press that piston down. And in the process of that, if the inside of the cylinder begins to get too hot, then we can put more fuel in there just to cool it down. We can use the law of thermodynamics to regulate the temperature inside the doggone cylinder. It's that simple. See, what I've been talking about all along isn't defying any of the known laws of physics. It's utilizing those laws of physics to your advantage. You know how the lens effects occurs. When you're trying to pull power off the same generator that you're trying to... You're running this generator and you're pulling the power off the same generator, and that generator is allowing the electron flow to go out the generator through your light bulb and right back into the same generator, then now you produce the second magnetic field that begins to act as a brake on the armature and slows it down. And so that field, those two fields were trying to balance each other out, and they're canceling each other out. They're getting to a point where they'll come to a complete standstill. But if you don't want to do that, then you take that energy off the generator that you want, move it into a completely different state of matter, a different form of energy at a different frequency range, and transfer that energy away from that generator so it never goes back in. There's no way that the electron flow can make it back in there. The pressure in the plasma reactor, for example, would be too high for the electrons to flow backwards. And an electron or a rectifier or a diode will only allow current to flow in one direction. That's how you get DC current. There's materials inside that diode that only allow the current to flow in one direction. In plumbing, you got check valves that will only allow the water to flow in one direction. It won't allow the pressure to come back the other way. And the only way that the pressure can overcome that check valve is if the pressure on the opposite side somehow or another becomes higher than the pressure input on the opposite side. But since that's not the case, then the check valve works fine. And the same thing with the plasma reactor is that when you're pushing that energy through, the pressure inside there is too much for the electrons to be able to go back the other direction. Would be the equivalence of you trying to swim up the river instead of down the river. You understand what I'm saying? But nonetheless, it's just about using energy in a more efficient manner. That's we never had an energy crisis. And as far as new green energy or alternative renewable energies, all that kind of stuff, they've been there all along. And for those that say that they're not, and the hunt is still on, it's because they don't understand and they didn't pay attention in school. I paid attention in school, and I was brave enough to question what I was being taught in school. Because if you say that water is hydrogen and oxygen, but you say you can't use it as a fuel because it takes too much energy, you never get out much energy as you put in, and so forth and so on, which is pure ridiculousness. Because I did a video called Hydrogen Danger, and one balloon full of hydrogen was enough that the acoustic wave was so incredibly loud that it muffled out the piezoelectric speaker in the microphone, and all you heard on there was a pew, but in real life you heard a huge boom that rocked the house. That's a lot of power. And so if you got that much power in just a little balloon, just think about a cylinder full of hydrogen. You don't need that much. If you measure out what the foot pound per square inch of down force that you're going to need from an explosion or an implosion, then you know exactly how much fuel to put into that thing. And I'm telling you right here now, if you've ever seen a flashback arrestor on a hydrogen cell go off, then you can see there's a lot of power inside that. And if you adjusted this thing just right and only put in the amount necessary to force that piston down, because you're not going to force it down any quicker than it's going to go down anytime it explodes. You're not going to get it to do it any faster. And the more speed that you get going on there, the more RPMs in that motor, the less fuel you're going to need to put into it. It's like sitting there tapping that wave. You won't need as much fuel. The faster you go, the less fuel you're going to require if it's properly engineered. It's like the 10-speed bicycle that you ride around. If you try to start off in the very first gear or the highest gear, you just ain't going to be able to do it very easy. It's going to be a lot of work to start off there. But you start off in the low gear, and then the faster you get going, you go into the next highest gear, and you get going faster and so on down the line. And then finally, whenever you're just cruising right along, you're barely having to hit that pedal, and you're still gaining speed. The same thing, if an engine was properly engineered, you should use less fuel the harder you drive that thing. Until you come to a complete stop and have to restart that whole cycle over again and start off with the beginning amount that you started off with and then work your way back down to the bare minimum again. The standard automobiles out here should be designed so that if they're going to be running off of gasoline, that the harder somebody steps on the gas pedal, the less fuel is necessary when you get to a certain speed. It don't take the same amount of fuel once this thing is already up and running. And it's not rocket science, because there's things in gasoline, gasoline's liquefied. There's water in gasoline. Regardless of what anybody wants to think, there is water in your gasoline. And at some point, that water becomes combustible. In the old days, they used to get the tractors up to operating temperature and begin to inject small quantities of water in, and they'd run the tractors to save fuel. Airplanes did it as well, but they could only do it for so long because it would cause their engines to get too hot and they could blow a head off of the engine. But nonetheless, it still shows it's proven science. The same thing with electricity. We know how to use it, and you know, even in some of the hydrogen cells that they've got, fuel cells, they you're able to, whenever the hydrogen is combining, splitting apart and recombining, that it actually produces an electrical charge. So if you got that electrical charge, you wouldn't even need a spark plug on the doggone thing, because the compression ignition would do all the work, and you'd have an electrical charge right in the cylinder when that thing's actually occurring. Now, you have two things, the electrical and the temperature and the compression, in order to be able to cause that water to ignite inside a properly engineered piece of machinery. It's that simple. And for all the mechanics out there that think I'm crazy, I'm telling you, try it before you deny it. Give it a shot. Because if you inject water into a cylinder, I took a cordless drill and a little weed eater motor, and I started running that up to raise the temperature up inside the cylinder, and the compression gets hotter and hotter in there, and started spraying in with a squirt bottle little bits of water. Well, when it gets up to a certain temperature, it begins to buck. You can tell it's trying to start. But because of the method by which I was introducing the water into that cylinder, it did exactly what the laws of thermodynamics talked about. It would begin to, because liquid can't be compressed, it would begin to cool down the cylinder. But if you had an induction heater around the cylinder, cylinder wall itself, or even around the head, if you had an induction heater around there, you can turn that induction heater on, which will cause the metal in between the coils to get hot. You can raise the thing up to 300 degrees Fahrenheit, and then it'll shut itself off once the thermostat reaches that temperature. It will automatically kick itself off. But nonetheless, that cylinder is already pre-treated at 300 degrees. The water circulating through the tube is already being heated up by the radiant heat off of the same cylinder. So you're not going to be spraying cool water into the cylinder. The hot water will be basically already up to steam temperature by the time it gets around to an atomizer and then into a vaporizer that will send only the amount necessary to cause that piston to go down. Once that water hits that superheated cylinder, it will expand 1600 times its volume, pushing that piston down. And on the upstroke will be creating compression, which in turn, that compression and the temperature is enough to begin to separate the hydrogen and oxygen molecules of the water. The separation, the temperature, the heat, and the pressure is enough for compression ignition that will cause that thing to begin to run off of water. Now, what I just explained to you, they've already done it, but in a cruder fashion, in tractors and airplanes. It's not that you can't run an internal combustion engine off of water. It's that an internal combustion engine wasn't specifically engineered to do so with that type of fuel. And if you could build this engine, when it's raining outside, you fill your fuel tank up. You could use this internal combustion engine to turn the crude generators, and there wouldn't even be no reason to even worry about trying to find free renewable alternative energy, because you could run this engine all doggone day long and never run out of fuel. Unless you was living up in the desert, But even in the desert, you can take that humid air and you can get more fuel right out of the doggone air. And if you utilize the energy coming off of that generator in a completely different fashion than the standard way that we do it now, then you'll get more use out of that energy out the other side without having to have that that generator work as hard. So folks, the answers have been there. They've been there all along. And the more that I get bombarded with trolls and people that just don't seem to want to understand because their school book said something completely different, you know, it comes a time when people start to even doubt their own deal. But when I put that video out there called Solved, what I saw in that video, what I showed people in that video, was something that science says can't be done. You can never get out more than you put in. That's what they said. Now, I started off with 7.3 volts. Run it through a motor controller, which is going to use up some of that energy out of that battery. Then I run that motor controller into a 12 volt electric motor, which is going to use some energy out of that battery. And then I use that electric motor to spin a homemade generator head made out of a carousel motor out of a microwave. And then I turn that, which is going to take away from power in the system. Then I turn that electricity, the AC current coming out of that, through a full wave bridge rectifier, and turned it into DC current, which I in turn charged up a nickel metal hydride battery to over 8.5 volts. Now, what I saw there, I know I'm right. No ifs, ands, or buts. Beyond a shadow of a doubt. It's not that we don't have enough energy. It's that the energy that we're using, we're not using efficiently. We're not using it right. If things are getting hot, that means they're meeting resistance. And once any material reaches its thermal breakdown, it will fail. The water engine that I was talking about, bringing the temperature up to 300 degrees Fahrenheit, is not going to hurt that engine, because the melting temperature of the aluminum is much higher. And so as long as you can maintain a constant 300 degrees Fahrenheit inside there, and all the materials inside there are of equal melting temperatures, then the inside of that cylinder will never fail. It's always the weakest one that's going to fail. And if you have a harder material rubbing up against a softer material, then it's obvious you're going to have damages occur. But if these two materials are the same hardness and they're remaining at the same temperature, and they're well lubricated, then they will never fail. It is possible for us to literally design an engine that will never fail. It's that simple. And if you need to cool the cylinder down for some reason, then you utilize the laws of thermodynamics and spray too much fuel in it, and you'll cool it down. But if you try to talk to somebody who had their nose in a school book, who thinks that they know everything there is to know about a vehicle and internal combustion engines, they ain't going to hear it. They don't want to hear it, because it rejects what they've been taught. And you can't go against that. But you find somebody in a machine shop who will ask no questions, just build it the way that I said, just build it. And we'll prove it. We'll build an engine that runs on pure distilled water. If the oil in the engine reaches its thermal breakdown, the viscosity changes, which is the thickness of the oil. The oil begins to thin out, and at certain points gets too thin to do its proper lubrication, then the system will begin to fail. But there are synthetic oils out there that can withstand extreme heat without failing. And there are different thicknesses of oil that can withstand extreme heat. So, in our system, you just need to find one that won't exceed will withstand 300 degree temperatures. If it will withstand 300 degree temperatures and still retain its lubrication properties, then the oil will never fail. And since you're not burning any carbon inside of the cylinder, then your oil will never even get dirty. You won't even need a doggone filter, because there won't be no carbon blow by past the cylinder rings in order to dirty up the oil. That black stuff that's inside of your oil is carbon blow by from an improperly engineered system that we use today. The way that the rings on the cylinder, when the compression happens, it causes them rings to actually expand out and make a seal around the cylinder as they're going down, so that they don't allow very much of the carbon to get through there. But nonetheless, even if you got two or three rings on the same piston, there's still a gap that oil that can work its way through. And unless you got a good, clean, proper burn in the combustion chamber, then your oil will get cruddy. And if your oil fails because of the carbon buildup in it and plugs up your filter, then it doesn't circulate through and it doesn't protect the parts, and something else will fail. But a properly engineered internal combustion engine could be designed to run on pure distilled water. And using the simple science of electricity, of how it actually works and how energy actually travels, whether you believe in the electron theory or not, doesn't matter. We just use the electron theory to explain to people how science says that something is occurring. All we're doing is we're tapping into energy that already existed. Anytime we're charging a battery or a capacitor, all we're doing is throwing the environment inside that battery off balance. We're putting more pressure on one side than on the other. And then when we turn our light bulb on, then that energy makes it through the light bulb. The resistance of the material causes it to get hot or not. And then that energy will finally balance itself back out on the opposite side, and the battery will be considered dead until you recharge it. I understand the mechanics of exactly what is going on, the way that energy travels, and I'm trying to explain it into a understandable range to where the average Joe and even the educated, I got more confidence in the average Joe than I do the educated. And maybe a light bulb will kick on in her head and they'll understand, yeah, that's right. That's how plumbing works. That's how electronics works. That's how electricity travels. It's all the same. All we're doing is taking energy waves and we're pulsing them at whatever frequency range necessary to get the work done as rapidly or slowly as possible. That's it. So, I'm going to be working on a solid state circuit using MOSFETs, because MOSFETs are a little bit more durable than transistors, and there are different timings to take in consideration. And so I'm also going to throw in a potentiometer so that I can adjust the voltage input up and down so that I can time it out to where I want it to be. It's like the volume knob on your stereo. You bring it up to your comfortable level and then you stop turning the knob. That's what I want to do with the circuit, and I want to put it in kit form and send it out to other researchers who are willing to test it and try to see how far that it could be expanded on, so that if somebody has to pay for electricity, they can use this circuitry to get this energy to do more work for less input. Make it more efficient. It's as simple as that. Right now, you got an alarm clock, a digital alarm clock in your house. It takes 120 volts input if you're in the States, 220 probably overseas, 50 hertz over there, 60 hertz over here, and it runs a 9 volt either AC or DC circuit depending on which model you got. Some of them have 9 volt DCs that'll run it, and some of them have 9 volts AC that'll run that same doggone circuit. But either way, by the time it gets to the LEDs portion of it, it's changed over to DC current anyway. And still, instead of putting 120 to 220 volts to that alarm clock, why couldn't you just put what it's necessary to actually run the circuit and save yourself some money? That's the point. Make it more efficient. Make the circuit boards cheap enough that somebody wanted to donate a bunch of them to third world countries. They could use any homemade battery to run the circuit to give them enough power to run an inverter or a converter, whichever one they need, whether they need AC or DC current. And if you got a cheapo solar panel, that's going to be more than enough to run the circuit that would run your inverter, that would run your heavier duty, more wasteful appliances. Because you could take that energy and you can step it up and move it into whatever form and whatever quantity you needed to run your deals. And there's nothing hoodoo voodoo about it. There's no tricks going on. It's just using the laws of physics to the advantage to getting the best out of what you could possibly get out of every bit of energy that you put into it. It doesn't take near as much power to run the average household as is put in to the average household. You got thousands of volts coming down those power lines at a really high frequency. They're dumped into the equivalence of a storage tank / step-down transformer that not only changes the frequency, but it stores some power pressure potential and then gives you anywhere from 100 amp to 200 amp service with one or single, dual, or triple phase, whatever your needs are. And it's doing it in the most wasteful manner possible. Believe me, those folks don't want you messing with their power lines. And so just the fear of you being near those power lines is enough to keep you away from them. But if you understand how that energy is being transmitted from where it's coming from, whether it be a hydroelectric dam or a nuclear power plant or whatever, all of them are basically pressure turbines, whether it be steam pressure or water pressure, that is turning a magnetic rotor using brute force magnetic field to shake loose the electrons in the copper to produce an AC current that in turn is brought up to a really high frequency and then sent down the power line to your house. It's not rocket science. And you don't have to be some sort of college-educated genius to understand what it is. If you want to understand it on the simple term, go out there, turn your garden hose on, and look at the water stream that's coming out of your garden hose away from your face, and then put your thumb over it. You just learned about pressure. It's that simple. You had probably 60 PSI behind the valve. You opened the valve and allowed the current to flow. And then you wanted to step up that pressure and you put your thumb over it, which restricted the volume coming out and caused the pressure to increase. That's all they've been doing, is putting their finger over the garden hose. And you've been paying them a large amount of money per month for doing so. So, with these circuits, simple, go out there and test. Ludic Science took a IRF Z44, or you can use an IRF 3205, work well. He said use any power MOSFET. The resistor is 180 to 220 ohms, about a half a watt. So you got a resistor, a MOSFET, a power input running a coil around the core of the flyback transformer with a center tap. The center tap is the positive in you to your power supply. And the other two are the other ends of the coil. And it's that simple. And you can mimic a magnetic field that produces 10,000 volts. Which is a lot of pressure. Otherwise it wouldn't hurt. Well, I don't know how much more simpler to put. So you call in to agitate at the very last 2 minutes.
Yeah, agitate, aggravate. I can think of a few more good words.
Cool. So have you been listening in at all or anything?
No, not at all.
Oh.
Sorry. I'm babysitting the laundromat and thrift shop. There's nobody here now.
All right, well, essentially, I posted some links about a little simple circuit that Ludic Science did to make a flyback driver, and I'm trying to get people to take the simple design and run some tests. What the heck happened? And run some tests on different transformers that they got and get the results out of it. Because what I believe is possible, on top of what I did in my latest video, solved, is that we have the potential to literally build the perfect solid state circuit, a combination inverter, converter, that will take the least amount of input and give the most amount of power output. And even with the way that that sounds, I'm still not talking about getting out more than you put in. What I'm talking about is using that power potential of whatever size your battery is to get the maximum amount of work done. It's the equivalence of taking a stream of gas to a flame or a vapor of gas to a flame. The reaction that you get afterward. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
So, we know that vaporized gas is more explosive than liquid gas. See what I mean?
Yep.
And so the same thing would apply with electricity, because how liquids work in nature, they also work in what we're doing here. Water is a liquid, so it can't be compressed. And so with no compression available, then thermodynamics, according to the laws of physics, would kick in, and that's what you would get your cooling portion with. You see what I mean?
Right.
So, if we built a water engine, and the temperature in the cylinder got above the operating temperature, which would be about 300 degrees Fahrenheit, then all we'd have to do in order to bring that temperature back down is put too much fuel in. And that would cool it back down. You see what I mean?
Yeah, you can only heat so much water up to a certain amount with so much surface area to bleed it off. So, yeah, you can regulate pretty well that way.
Yeah.
Or put it under pressure. Then you can go to a higher temp if you want.
I just used that thermodynamics for worst case scenario that it got overheated. But, you know, as long as you never reach the thermal breakdown of any material, then 300 degrees Fahrenheit isn't going to melt aluminum block. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
And as long as it never reaches that thermal breakdown to where that metal becomes softer, that now it can, whatever hard part is rubbing up against it will begin to destroy it because it's now softer. If you got aluminum rings and aluminum head and all made out of the same exact alloy, those have the same exact melting temperature. And so if it never reaches its thermal breakdown, then you wouldn't have to use the injection of too much water into the cylinder in order to cool it down. You'd just be running it as normal. Because what's the boiling temperature of water? Is it like 212 or is it 112 at sea level?
212.
Okay. 212 degrees at sea level. It'll boil. And so using the induction heating system, you can heat it up to right at boiling temperature and pre-treat that water so that by the time it goes through the atomizer and then finally into a sonic vaporizer system and inject only the amount necessary to create the reaction to push that piston down. The faster you get going with this thing, the faster this engine fires, the less fuel is necessary for you to put it in there. It's like riding a 10-speed bicycle. You see what I mean?
Right. Yeah, taking just up to the right temp and leave it there.
Yep. And just like a diesel engine, the only time that doggone glow plug has to come on is to heat the cylinder to when, you know, operating temperature, the induction portion of the cylinder, it would only come on like during the winter time whenever the cylinder dropped down to below the operating temperature, it'd have a thermal switch to turn it on and off. And that's it. The rest of the time, it's using compression ignition to basically fire the engine. So if you understand that, and then you understand how to use the energy more efficiently, you could get so much more work out of this doggone generator than you would have been otherwise just running it direct. You see what I mean?
Yep. You know, as far as the steam engine goes, like the old locomotives, I always figured they should have had two boiling chambers. One to bring most of the water up close to temp, and the other one that they could put a fire on, which is a smaller boiler, and that would have given the quicker reaction and everything, plus a little bit more efficiency.
Yeah. Well,
I wonder why they didn't invent that.
I don't know.
To me, it makes a lot of sense. Why heat all of your water?
I think that
heat a portion of it up there to where you can get it up close to temp, and then when you need it, you throw it into the rest and just heat it just a little bit of fuel, sit there and make that thing sing.
Back in the old days, in the old Navy ships that had boilers, we had fuel oil that we would vaporize and ignite and send into a basically like a cage of piping. And it would get those pipes in there red hot. And then when they injected the water into those pipes, it would instantaneously superheat and flash to steam, and there's where they got their pressure. But that was a lot of power, man. Now, you're talking about 650 to 1250 PSI per boiler that were turning huge turbines, that were turning huge motors, that were turning the screws. That's a lot of power. But that same concept on a smaller scale using induction heating, you see what the induction heaters do when they're to the metal in between them, right?
Oh, yeah.
And it don't take long at all before that metal is red hot. So you wouldn't even have to have it on very long.
As long as it's conductive, it's sitting there. It's the same thing as a lens.
Yeah.
You got a magnetic field going on a straight piece of metal. Anywhere on that piece of metal where the center of that deal is you have a magnetic field trying to generate a circle of electricity.
Yep.
Oh, you're just putting the current right through the metal even though it's not touching.
Mutual
inductance.
Inside your microwave oven, there are these little thermal switches. And they're pretty neat for projects because you can get these out of there and basically you could hook a power source to it, and while the thing is cool, it will allow current to flow through it. But once the surface of this area gets hot, the thermal switch in there breaks the circuit and shuts it off. So these little things right here are technology that put up to the side of that engine. When that engine gets too hot, it'll shut off the induction portion. You see what I mean?
Yep.
But that came out of a microwave oven. Those are for if your transformer gets too hot, it'll shut it off. If the heat box gets too hot, it'll shut it off. So the technology that we're talking about, it's already done. You just got to put those pieces of the puzzle in the right direction.
Yep, you got thermistors.
Thermostats.
What is what?
Thermostats. Thermal. They turn stuff on, off.
Right. They got the bimetal ones in dryers.
And the thermal couples inside of your furnace are to do the opposite, to turn stuff on. Basically, those when the heat box gets up to a certain temperature and produces enough electricity, it will tell the thermostat to shut itself off. So there's two different ways that you can regulate that temperature. But this is a more mechanical version that are in the microwaves. But anyway, everything that I'm talking about is all basic. But it has the implications of making it so that your efficiency in your house is so incredible that the power company be trying to say you're stealing electricity when you're not. I told a story before you came on here, Muddy, about a guy that, and this is a real story. Guy built a generator that he was able to plug into one outlet of his house. Alright, and then he ran that generator off of that one outlet of his house. The rest of the house, he ran off of the generator. And so the power company got suspicious and thinking he's stealing electricity. When in reality, he was paying for everything he was using. Somehow or another, they either bought him off, bribed him out, threatened him, or whatever. But you never heard about it anymore.
Actually, the man went to jail.
went to jail.
All of his research and everything like that got taken and destroyed.
Well, that don't surprise me none.
He was renting from a lady. Yep. He's also the same guy that, John Searle. That was John Searle. He's the one that made that flying saucer, which is basically he had that thing spinning so quick and stuff, and ham radio operators were flying it all over the UK.
Well, you know what? That flying saucer technology, it's not beyond science fact. You can see. When you take two opposite fields from just a regular stationary magnets, that they repel each other or they all attract each other. And so when you know what's going on in the environment, you can mimic that. And that's basically what I was saying with the magnetic field for as pulsing generator heads. I believe it's possible to build a circuit that will replace the internal combustion engine on every single generator head. So that's what I'm working on. And that and a custom made transformer that I'm going to use microwave oven transformers, but I'm going to do something really cool with them in order to make it a combination transformer capacitor that will mimic what the one on the pole does. You see what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Anyway, we're getting down to it, man. The simple of the whole deal is people got tons and tons of ideas, and then stop arguing about whose idea is right and whose idea is wrong, because maybe they're all right and maybe they're all wrong. But nonetheless, you know, this journey through the alternative energy community has been aggravating, stressful, sometimes rewarding, and so much more. Because I kept hearing all kinds of things, Bedini, Tesla, Searle, and everybody else, all these different names out there. And all they ever do with what they're trying to tell you about each of these technologies is muddy up the water. You don't have to go into some sort of high-tech terminology to make people understand basic science. And so all you got to do is understand what's happening, and then you can utilize those forces to your advantage. And that's what I've been talking about all along.
I hear you.
Tesla had good, great research. Bedini and Searle and all the other guys out there that you name brands that you hear in alternative energy research, they all had their pluses and they all had their minuses. If they would have came together a long time ago and put their egos aside, there ought to be a free energy device sitting on the table. As far as I'm concerned, there already is a free energy device sitting on the table. But I got to put together a gizmo that is 150,000% beyond a shadow of doubt irrefutable. Not because I have something to prove to the world, because I want to prove it once and for all. It's that simple. Now, I don't care whether the world believes what I'm saying or not. I wish they would. I wish they'd try it. I wish they'd take this circuit that Ludic Science put out there and watch this video of 1.5 volts to 220 volts AC inverter. And my video solved. Watch all of them. Sit back, look at the big picture, and see how far you could take that information. These doggone, this flyback driver circuit that he made, it's only got two, two components, electrical components. It's got copper wire, it's got a resistor and a transistor, and then he's got that going around the core of a transformer, a flyback transformer. And you don't even have to use a flyback transformer. You can grab any transformer and pulse the same coil. And that's why I'm saying that if you took a regular microwave oven transformer, which I've seen them use the same circuit to do that with the microwave oven transformer, and get over 10,000 volts out the other side, then there ain't no reason why you couldn't slow that transistor or that MOSFET down to whatever hertz range you needed in order to be able to build up the current on the secondary. You see what I mean?
Uh-huh.
The faster you go, the higher the voltage. The slower you go, the higher the current. That's what science says. It's as simple as that. The circuitry that we're using is too fast. But you can take that same circuitry and modify it with something as simple as a potentiometer to limit the voltage going in, or even use capacitors to time out when your current surges will go to that transistor and get it to time exactly where you want it.
And if you're going to change the frequency, let's not forget about the variable capacitor that finishes up the tank circuit.
Yep. I did a video some time back called Homing Beacon. And in that video, I basically was able to time out those capacitors to match my own heartbeat. I was able to get it to be on the same exact beat. Because if you understand how a capacitor works, a larger one takes longer to fill up. A smaller one takes less time to fill up. If an LED has to have a certain amount of energy in it, then that you can time it out to when you want that LED to blink. You see what I mean?
Yeah. The capacitor is like a balloon.
Yep.
The bigger the balloon, the bigger the capacity of air it can hold, or water.
Well, I took all of what science said.
Yeah, put a small hole on the beginning of the balloon, and to where it, a small orifice for the water to go through. That's like your resistor.
Yep.
You only get so much current. When it clips up enough current, gets big enough, gets up under another pressure, trips the transistor. That's my clock I've been working on this morning.
Hey, you in London?
Say again.
Are you in London?
No.
Sound like Big Ben. Anyway, I understand what you're saying. Folks, look, I paid attention in school. I paid attention in science. I took all that information and went on a journey to find free energy, and I'm here to share what I've learned. It's as simple as that. Now, I'm going to share it in the most simplest fashion without all the use of the high-tech terminology and fancy equations to explain to you what's going on, so that if you utilize this information and do a bit of research of your own, you'll get to the point where your house will be so efficient that, you know, if you had to pay a light bill, it wouldn't be any significance. And utilizing this technology so that people around the world who need electricity can have electricity. When I say need, I guess we don't really need it, but it's once you get used to being able to turn the light on, it's kind of nice. You see what I mean?
Get spoiled.
Yeah. Well, anyway, now the world needs energy, and we need to be able to get from point A to point B. We have the potential to literally build electric cars or hydrogen electric or whatever. and be able to work in perfect harmony with nature and be able to breathe straight after we're done without all the crud in the air. They said that there was too much carbon emissions. I'm giving them the answers to resolve it if they're willing to get together with engineers and do it. It's that simple. Comes a point in time when you're hollering about global warming / climate change / climate disruption or whatever it's going to be next week when the math don't add up and somebody's getting rich off of fear-mongering the world, saying the world's coming to an end because of global warming or whatever. When a guy like myself who paid attention in school stands up and says we have the answers and nobody's listening, there's something wrong. Because we got every single piece of the puzzle necessary to resolve all the so-called issues of the world. Instead, what we're doing is allowing people to pollute our waterways, to pollute our airways, to destroy the earth, just because we want to be able to turn on the lights and stomp on the gas pedal.
Yeah.
We can still do all the fun stuff, but we can do it in such a clean fashion that it'd be beneficial for all of humanity. And there ain't no hoodoo voodoo version in nothing what I said. It's all the same exact science that I was taught in school, but I had the guts to question how far you can take it and whether they were right or whether they were wrong. Folks, you've been listening to Mad Science. I hope you learned something. I hope I helped you out in some sort of small way or big way or whatever. The show kind of started off a little bit not so well today, but I think it ended off with a good note. But if you liked any of it, cut and chop it. Share it with whoever you like. Share it on your social media networks. Bring some people to the chat room. That's it. Tomorrow during the Knights of the Round Table, I want to ask everybody, we're going to have a Bring a Friend Day tomorrow at the Knights of the Round Table. Bring a friend to the chat room for the Knights of the Round Table, where we can talk about more solutions. Peace and love, everybody. You've been listening to Mad Science. Take care.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.